Hello and welcome to The Approach. This podcast explores ideas from Carleton University's Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences. My name is Philip Primo. I'm an instructor in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology and your host for this podcast series. Each episode features a unique conversation with a different person from across the faculty's many departments, programs, and institutions. Different people, different approaches, one big academic community. This series not only showcases the work that goes on at Carleton, but also how a degree in the arts and social sciences can help you approach the ideas that matter most to you. Today, we'll be hearing from Danny Printa, Indigenous Cultural Engagement Coordinator at the Carleton University Art Gallery. Danny has a BA in art history, interned at the National Gallery of Canada, and completed the Aboriginal Training Program in Museum Practices at the Canadian Museum of History. She has worked at SAW Gallery, the Indigenous Art Centre, and the City of Ottawa's Public Art Program. We spoke to Danny about art as resistance, Indigenous ontologies, and how working as an art curator helps deepen their connection to their community.
Yes, thank you for having me. My name is Danny. I am Algonquin and Onondaga from Kitigamsibi. I also have roots in Oswegan, and I live and work here in Ottawa. I also have an independent practice outside of the gallery where I work as an independent curator. So I develop and create different art exhibitions for galleries.
Danny, I'm sort of wondering, can art serve as a form of resistance?
Yeah, I think art serves definitely as an important role, you know, in enacting resistance, especially for, you know, Indigenous peoples. You know, when art is able to allow us to represence ourselves, you know, represence our bodies on our own territories. I mean, that's a form of resistance in itself, because we've been forcefully removed from our own territories and forcefully displaced from them. You know, that it happens even today. So, you know, even art that shows me, you know, on my own territory, you know, being alive and as a Algonquin person, as an Onondaga person, that is itself a form of resistance. I think Indigenous artists too, especially, have gotten really, you know, clever and really good at understanding how to use material and use media to re-examine the history, re-examine the past, and those long-standing, you know, historical narratives that still impact us today. And they're able to do it in a way that's, you know, questioning those narratives and trying to destabilize them, right? Because we're still grappling with those power relations that are entrenched in those historical narratives. And I think a lot of artists, you know, whether directly or indirectly, you know, by making art in Canada at this time, that in itself is a form of resistance. And, you know, the conversations too that can be had, you know, through art, I think those enact resistance themselves. You know, the kind of happenings, gatherings, dialogues that happen in the gallery space, you know, we have to confront a lot of these things head on. And, you know, it can make for very eye-opening conversations to explore these things together. I think art allows us to question these things, right? And, you know, not as a way to just get answers, but as a, like, just the act of us constantly questioning, you know, it opens dialogue up, it opens things up to talk about. And art serves as a catalyst for that, to do that work that's required for us all to help us, you know, enact resistance. So, you know, it can be a better place for a lot of people, especially marginalized people.
Speaking as a curator, what role do museums and galleries play when it comes to enacting Indigenous resistance through art?
I think, you know, like if I was to bring my niece, like I've brought in my niece, you know, to art exhibitions, and for her as a young person to just see her culture represented, you know, on these big walls, like that's a pretty phenomenal thing. And I think it has the power to expand Canadian consciousness of Indigenous experience. You know, when the education system has failed to do that, you know, we look to our museums to and our cultural spaces to be able to do that work. And I think, you know, the fact that, you know, major bodies like the National Gallery, you know, have to think about what it means to grapple with their history, and also presence and center marginalized voices, you know, center Indigenous voices, to be able to dismantle and be a part of that, you know, reworking, you know, especially when the work can be supported by its own ideas, when it doesn't, it's not added to a narrative to support a certain conversation. The work is able to stand on its own and be regarded for the ideas that the artists want to engage in. You know, there's no, I think Native art, you know, in the museum and gallery space, it had to, at one point in time, you know, look a certain way. It had to say a certain thing. A lot of, you know, galleries didn't want to challenge or provoke ideas, especially ideas that they felt complicit in. And I think that now spaces are more willing to do that work. Well, they understand that they have to, right? And so even if the, you know, work is about the institution itself or, you know, challenges it, it's still there, right? So I think that representation is so important, especially because it wasn't allowed for so long. You know, certain kinds of motifs and aesthetics were thought to be the purveyors of Indigenous art, you know, the standards, but now Indigenous art is so versatile. Well, it always has been, but now there's more opportunity for it to be, right? The artist doesn't have to rely on these certain aesthetics to have representation or to be shown in a gallery. The artist can explore, or is encouraged to explore, the ideas that they want to.
And how would you go about enacting or displaying or maybe practicing this sort of disposition at Carleton in your work at the art gallery?
Yeah, I think there's many ways, and we keep creating new ones too, like through community discussions, you know, that happen through symposia, artist talks, specially developed programs that coincide with these themes that the artists explore, that these exhibitions explore. So like for the Christie Belcourt exhibition, we did Fiona Wright, who is the student and public programs coordinator. She planned a community banner making kind of day-long event. And so we had so many people come to Fenn Lounge on campus, and we created and silkscreened banners together. And these banners were sent, you know, all over Canada to be used in demonstrations. You know, demonstrations that support the protection of land, of water, you know, support resistance against resource extraction. So like we do these kind of, that was a really ambitious activity, but it was really wonderful for us to like just make things as a community together that support the artists, you know, that support the work that they want to do outside of the gallery, in a way that, I don't know, there was like a collective kind of intention. And I think when we make time to do those things, you know, bigger things can happen. And so the fact that we, you know, made these banners together, they got sent, you know, they were used on the front lines. I mean, that's directly relating, you know, to resistance, is all of that frontline, you know, advocacy and work that is happening throughout Canada.
How do you try to articulate the complex relationship between people and land within your work and your curation practice in particular?
I think that with what I do is just try to point to those complexities, right? And oftentimes, you know, people have, like when I'm doing tours or when I'm, you know, doing kind of talks or other types of art happenings, you know, I often get people that come up to me that don't know a lot about Indigenous peoples. They don't have a knowledge base, you know, and their knowledge base is misinformed, you know, they've been miseducated. And I think what I try to do is to allude to our the complexities within our relationships, to show that, you know, we have our own intellectual traditions. We have our own ways of knowing, in that we've always had them, to kind of, you know, like counter those narratives that, you know, we're romanticized, you know, we exist in the past. We don't know how, you know, we're not adaptable. We don't, you know, have our own ways of thinking that are deserving. Yeah, to your point, I think I just try to point to our complexities and our ways of thinking and being in relationship, you know, to land. I think our relationship to land is something that has been extremely oversimplified. You know, like when I was a student in school, and people would, you know, ask me, oh, is it true that like Native people believe everything, you know, has a spirit and those kinds of things? And it's like, well, yeah, but like not in the way that like you're thinking of, you know, like we believe that things are animate and alive, but that doesn't simplify us, you know? And I think that's been happening, you know, since colonization, is they saw us living in a very, what they perceived to be primitive, right? But we had our own medicine, you know, we had our own extensive knowledges of land, you know, and a lot of that has been severed. And I think a lot of artists are in their work reacquainting themselves with those understandings. You know, someone like Christy Belcourt, again, like she learned with a knowledge keeper a lot of the Métis use of medicine and plants. And, you know, that's an extensive array of knowledge that becomes embodied by one plant. You know, when you can pick it, how you use it, what its properties are. You know, when you extend that to like a whole biodiversity system, that's a fairly massive amount of knowledge, right? And that knowledge connects you, you know, to that plant and to its properties in a much deeper way. So I think those things often get missed. You know, they're not talked about in school, and we're talked about, well, back when I was in school, you know, we're talking about like how Native people knew how to, you know, harvest corn and things like that. It wasn't, there was no, you know, referral to actually the fact that, you know, we could do surgeries. You know, we used like the bones of hummingbirds, and we had extensive medicine knowledge, and that's not a part of this collective Canadian consciousness, right? Is just how advanced that we actually have always been. And so I think I try to point to our intellectual traditions and in the work that I do, so that it kind of holds our integrity and, you know, generates visibility, generates awareness. A lot of people don't know these things. So I think education has helped in dismantling a lot of those oversimplifications of indigeneity.
Sort of brings to mind one of the things I do in an undergraduate course I teach about the lineages of racialized music and religion. I teach this selection from Dylan Robinson called Hungry Listening, Resonant Theory for Indigenous Sound Studies. This book is a reimagining of how we hear and listen to sounds all around us, including music. And importantly, Robinson argues that the Western settler colonial context has created this tin ear where we don't actually hear what's around us. The idea of hungry listening is a reimagining of what Indigenous ontologies and relationalities can offer us in terms of collective listening. And one of the things that I always find interesting from this selection when I teach to undergraduate students is how personal it can get, and how these broad intellectual and academic theories actually play a big part in our personal lives. For me, it's how I reimagine myself as a white settler, the structures I've been a part of. Maybe we can focus our discussion towards Indigenous ontologies and relationalities. I'm wondering, how do these things affect you, you as a person, you in your practice at Carleton? Yeah,
I think for me, it's a form of like presencing, you know, and back to this conversation on resistance, you know, like my family's been directly impacted by the residential school legacy. You know, we've been told to forget, you know, told to not remember, told that, you know, we're supposed to learn, you know, the kind of Western, education. And I think that me just, you know, making time to think about these things from, you know, this perspective is an act of resistance, you know, especially when there's been that, that forced culture loss, you know, that forced disempowerment, that forced erasure, you know, the fact that I take time to remember and to learn, you know, and to read people like Dylan Robinson and to watch work by Rebecca Belmore, the fact that I make an effort to do those things is in itself a form of resistance, right? Because my mother wasn't encouraged to do that. My grandmother wasn't encouraged to do that. And so it's my generation, you know, that are grappling with this, remembering and recentering work that we need to do. And I feel like, one, it adds to my own empowerment. You know, when I see people like Rebecca Belmore in performance, I feel empowered, you know, by her articulation. And I feel like it adds fuel, you know, to my own fire. The fact that, you know, I can bring my mom, you know, to an exhibition I curated, you know, talk to her about what I see this artwork to mean, understand what it means to her. I mean, that's all a part of the reason why I do this work, right? It connects me to my family. It connects me to my ancestry and connects me to my present day circumstance, right? So I think, you know, personally, I feel like this work is important in my, you know, empowerment, my own resistance, my constant unlearning and relearning of indigeneity, you know, what indigeneity has been communicated to me and what it actually is. So I think that artwork is the perfect catalyst to do that work. The expressions of artists is, and its ability, you know, to transform, I think is extremely important. I think that it definitely has like a personal weight. You know, when I'm doing a tour or when I'm, you know, doing a gathering and I'm talking about it, I feel like I'm in like this mode, you know, where it's like I'm like enacting something. You know, I'm giving weight to these ideas. I'm saying that this is what it is. I feel like I've been in many situations where I haven't had that kind of power or immediacy. And so when I'm able to enact it, it feels good, you know, in a way. And I've been able to connect with people too via art making. You know, other Indigenous peoples, we've been able to have extended conversations and dialogues together over art. You know, so I do think that it has a particular power for sure.
Thank you for listening. If you want to learn more about Carleton University's Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences, check us out on the web at www.carleton.ca/FASS, on Twitter at CU_FASS, and on Instagram at Carleton University FASS, all one word. You can find more episodes of The Approach wherever you listen to podcasts, and make sure to check out the show notes for links to other episodes as well as the transcripts. Until next time, take care.